are going to talk this hour with a political scientist about President Obama calling on Congress to authorize a military strike in Syria. We will also preview other issues on the congressional agenda once Congress returns for the fall session. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, September the 3rd. Today, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee will conduct its first hearing on the possible use of military force in Syria. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and Secretary of State John Kerry are expected to testify. And we want to know, what do you want Congress to do? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We are happy to have with us David Cannon, professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Now, when we set this up last Friday, we did not know that President Obama was going to ask Congress for authorization to use military force in Syria. Did that surprise you at all that he called for that?
Well, it did a little bit, because certainly he would not have needed Congress's authorization for a limited military strike like this. Presidents have done this kind of thing on their own for decades without congressional approval. So it seems pretty clear that the reason that he is doing this and asking for congressional authorization is to help provide political cover, because right now this is definitely a controversial position that he's taken. He hasn't gotten full backing from our allies. And so I think it strengthens his hand politically if he can get congressional approval. Now, on the other hand, if Congress, you know, votes it down, then this is a major blow politically, and one that I think was a risky move for him to do, for him to actually ask for congressional approval.
Yeah, he did also indicate that he might go it alone, even if Congress says no.
Right, and that I think, you know, makes it an even weaker position than it would have been had he just acted on his own without asking Congress, obviously. And so. So it really, it's a very tough spot that President Obama is in, because, you know, many people have argued that, you know, militarily there's little to gain from this, but he kind of put himself in a corner when he, you know, had the very strong red line kind of language saying that, you know, Syria can't cross the chemical weapons line. If they do, there's going to be consequences. And once the nation's credibility is at stake like that, you almost have to follow through, or you're going to lose your credibility the next time you make a threat. I think that's the position that President Obama has kind of painted himself into, that corner where, you know, maybe in an ideal world they say, well, let's just, you know, ignore this. It's really not something militarily that's going to benefit anyone on humanitarian grounds. You know, there have been 40,000 people killed by conventional weapons, and so how is that different than, you know, 1,000 people being killed by chemical weapons? So, you know, there's really no airtight argument you make on humanitarian grounds either for intervening now and not previously. And so it's really it comes down to this question of credibility, I think, that once the nation and the president, you know, makes a strong statement like that and issues a threat, basically you have to kind of follow through on that threat to maintain credibility.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at an article from USA Today. President Obama's bid to get congressional support to use military force in Syria received a boost yesterday as Republican Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham said they now have more confidence in the White House in developing a better strategy for dealing with Syria. What are the politics of this use of military force in Syria? It's something that Republicans want and Democrats don't, or is there a breakdown like that?
Well, it's certainly a mix. It's definitely, you know, we've seen such partisan politics in Congress for the last several years, where on many, many issues, it lines up, you know, 98% of Republicans are opposed to, you know, 98% of Democrats, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's a completely straight party line vote. And we've seen that in issue after issue. This one's not going to be like that. This one's going to be, you know, more of you know, what we call, you know, ends against the middle, I think, where you see the, you know, the sort of moderates in both parties in the middle, that'll be supporting the president, and then extreme liberals, who, are, you know, generally opposed to use of force are going to oppose the president, and then probably some extreme conservatives who just, you know, despise Obama and can't support him on anything will be opposing him as well. So that, I think we will see more of a bipartisan vote on this when it actually does come up for a vote. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Representative Ron Kind of Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District is among some of Wisconsin's congressional delegation who have reservations that he says, I want to see what evidence they have that the Assad regime did in fact deploy chemical weapons against its own people. Some people don't think there's enough evidence as to what exactly happened.
Well, yeah, that's what a lot of members of Congress are taking, a wait-and-see approach right now, wanting to be convinced this is necessary. And my guess is right now that, you know, once the vote actually happens, the president will get the authorization he needs. Because I find it hard to believe that they would have gone forward with this had they not had a pretty good indication from party leaders that they could deliver the votes. Both on the Democratic and Republican side. They must have had some assurances from Republican leaders that we can get you at least this many votes, and the Democratic leaders, I'm sure, must have said, you know, we're going to lose a few people, but we can get this many votes. So, there are members of Congress like Ron Kind who are still kind of holding their cards close to their chest and not wanting to reveal what they're going to do until they have more information. But I think when it comes to the final tally, I'd be really surprised if Congress doesn't vote to support the president on this.
Interesting. We had on the show last week Representative Mark Pocan of Madison and Representative Tom Petri of Fond du Lac, a Democrat and a Republican, and they both on this day were calling on the president to ask Congress for the authorization. Did Congress really want this, the request?
That's an excellent question. You kind of wonder if a lot of members of Congress would have preferred just to duck this one, because it is a really tough vote, I think, that in terms of, you know, and on maybe on policy grounds, you might say this probably isn't the best thing to do, that it could actually make things worse in the region. Let's say, you know, Syria were to decide they have to retaliate by striking Israel. Well, then what? The whole thing could, you know, turn into a regional war at that point. And so I'm sure that many members of Congress would have reservations on policy grounds, but then if you're a Democrat, you'd want to support your president, and if you're any member of Congress, you'd, I think, be somewhat persuaded by this question of the credibility of the foreign policy of the United States, if you don't want to be in a position where you go back on having made a threat like that. And so I think many members of Congress probably would have preferred, boy, let the president handle this one, and then we can criticize him if it goes wrong. Mm-hmm. But I really respect the members of Congress who stepped up and said, hey, we want to have a say in this as well. That's the way our government should work in our system of checks and balances and shared powers. I think it's ideal when members of Congress do play a role in major policy decisions like this. And I think it's much better for the country if we have both of the main branches of the lawmaking side of government participating in these major decisions. So I really applaud the members of Congress who stepped up and said, hey, let us be a part of this. We want to share this responsibility. That's the right thing to do.
So what are the political implications for members of Congress once they actually vote? And is this going to, I guess, hurt them with upcoming elections?
Well, in congressional politics, foreign policy typically does not play as major a role as it does for the presidency. We do tend to look to the president as the leader on foreign policy, as the commander-in-chief. And so members of Congress, you know, sometimes do have to make tough votes. And so you see votes like the, you know, support to for authorization of use of force for President Bush in the war in Iraq. Now, that was a foreign policy vote that did come back to hurt some members of Congress in some districts where it was used against them once the war turned to be, you know, less popular. And so it's possible this could be a vote like this down the road. Let's say that, you know, that we do decide to bomb Syria, and let's say things really do go much worse because of that, and it turns into a regional war. Well, then you can imagine this would be a vote that would come back to hurt a member of Congress down the road when an opponent could say, look, the member of Congress, you know, supported the use of force, and now look at the mess we're in because of that vote. And so this is a consequential vote, one of those rare ones that could turn into something that matters for a member of Congress, where typically a foreign policy vote doesn't really enter into congressional politics as much as it would in presidential politics. Yeah.
So another a piece in the Christian Science Monitor, an analysis piece, that said that President Obama actually weakened the presidency by seeking congressional approval. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, then, do you remember who wrote the article?
I'm sorry, I wish I did, but that was the headline from it.
Okay, because I was kind of curious if it was a political scientist who, sort of favors a strong presidency, because that sounds to me like someone who has this view that, the president should be just running the show on foreign policy and, should be, the only voice really in foreign policy for the country. And I just never bought that. I think that the country is better off, as I said before, when the Congress and President share war powers. Indeed, the way that the founders intended. When the founders wrote our Constitution, they gave Congress as much or more on the war-making powers than the president, that they gave Congress the right to declare war. They gave Congress the responsibility to raise and support armies. And so it was clear they wanted Congress to be an equal partner in the conduct of foreign policy and not have it be just dominated by the president. So that comment of the article in the Christian Science Monitor, I think, is clearly from the perspective of someone who wants the president to be the only voice on foreign policy. And from that perspective, yeah, it weakens the presidency. I think that's right. But in my view, that's the way it should be. It should be more of a shared power between the president and Congress on a really big, important decision like this.
We are talking with David Cannon. He is a political science professor at UW-Madison. We are talking with him about President Obama calling on Congress to authorize a military strike in Syria. We will also, as we go along, preview some of the issues that are on the congressional agenda now that Congress will be returning for the fall session. And we want to know, what do you want to see Congress do? What do you want your representative to tell President Obama regarding the use of force in Syria? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Professor David Cannon about Congress returning from recess this week with a variety of issues to tackle. The first one is going to be whether or not to grant approval for the use of force, military force, in Syria. President Obama called on Congress for that authorization on Saturday. And we're wondering what you want Congress to say about this. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We will, as we go along, branch off into other issues that are before Congress when Congress returns from the summer recess. But we'll spend the next few minutes anyway wondering what you think about this call to authorize military force in Syria. What is the process, Professor Cannon? It says here that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today is going to be holding its first public hearing on this issue. So they're not waiting until everybody's back in session.
Right. No. So the committees will often start hearings even before the full body is in session, and so they'll be calling witnesses, gathering facts, taking testimony, and then I would imagine soon after everyone is back in Washington, then there'll be some votes on authorization of the use of force. I haven't seen either the House or Senate talk about exactly when that would be, but it should be fairly soon after everyone's back in Washington.
Let's go to Gary in Iron River first. Hello, Gary.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
My two cents worth is I think he sort of accidentally or without understanding the consequences drew the red line, and there should have been a consultation and more thought before the red line was actually drawn, and he made that statement. However, it strikes me now that it's been done for the good of the future forever of presidencies. Congress has little choice other than to approve it.
Professor Cannon?
Yeah, interesting point. Yeah, I guess I don't know enough about the inside decision-making process in the White House to know if this was something that was done more accidentally, as Gary said, or if it had a lot of thought and debate before making that statement of the red line. But my sense is that something like that wouldn't be done just kind of cavalierly off the cuff, because one thing that we've seen from the Obama administration pretty consistently from his first term through the early part of the second term is it tends to be a very cautious, deliberative decision-making process in that White House. And so I guess I'd be surprised if we found out later that was something that was just more off the cuff and not well thought through. But whether or not it was, I think, Gary's making a very, strong statement on the point I said before that about the future credibility of American foreign policy for future presidents, and that once you issue a threat like that, you have to follow through. And I think that probably is the strongest reason for going ahead right now, because I'm, in fact, more convinced on the side of the skeptics to say that not much good would come from this. And so that, to me, seems like the credibility argument is the strongest one for taking some action now.
Yeah, why do you say not much good would come from a targeted strikes against Syria?
Well, just because it's hard to see, what advantage this would have. The only thing that, you could argue, I guess, in terms of other than the credibility argument, would be to say this would deter future use of chemical weapons in Syria and elsewhere. And I'm just not sure that's the case. I mean, someone like Assad has shown willingness to use chemical weapons, in the past. And so it's not clear to me he'd be deterred from using them again just if we have a military strike right now. And then when you add into that the possibility of an increased scope of conflict in the Middle East because of this, if Syria decides it has to retaliate then in kind and, say, attack Israel, then things could get dramatically worse because of this. And that's a lot of uncertainty surrounding how this would play out.
Jeff in Kenosha is with us. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning. Yes, because it is a civil war, and the United Nations then should be used to determine what should be done rather than like an invasion of a country. So then the Security Council has the ability to determine what action should be done, not only as far as Syria is concerned, but as a precedent for the rest of the world when or if chemical weapons are used.
Yeah. So should the U.N. Determine this, Professor Cannon?
Well, yeah, the U.N. already has spoken in terms of Russia and China at least being opposed to a military strike right now. And so if the U.N. gets the final word, then that's the end of the story, and we wouldn't be doing anything. I think President Obama obviously takes a different view, and that the U.N. plays a vital role in peacekeeping and a vital role in many other humanitarian efforts and so on. But for this kind of question of American foreign policy and our strategic interests, President Obama would say that we still have a sovereign interest in our own foreign policy, independent of and separate from the United Nations. And this is, I think Jeff, certainly makes a strong argument, and one that many people would share, that they'd like to see the UN playing a more central role than they do. But President Obama's position on this is pretty consistent, I think, with previous presidents as well, that there is a separate sovereign U.S. interest independent from the United Nations on issues where we believe that our strategic interests are at stake as well. Now, that's a whole separate question on Syria. Is this an instance where our strategic interests are at stake? And many would argue that no, there isn't, because this is basically a civil war. And so there's where I think the critical debate would need to occur on this.
Yeah. Well, Professor Cannon, we have a bunch of callers lined up that just want to say, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. What about public opinion in this? Does that matter?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that always public opinion matters in a democracy, and it obviously, needs to matter for, future support for policies in the United States. And so, yes, I think public opinion should matter in this. I mean, it's one of many considerations that come into play for the White House and for Congress when they, go forward on a decision like this. But absolutely, that comes into play.
Yeah. Well, we set up this interview to talk a little bit more about what else is in front of Congress now when it returns from its summer vacation, so to speak. What maybe you can, just before we have a minute before news time, what are some of a quick laundry list of the major issues before Congress?
Well, the two big things, I think, right now, and that received all the attention before Syria dominated the front page for the last week, were the debt ceiling extension, which we are going to revisit the crisis from a little over a year ago, where the President and Congress went toe-to-toe on increasing the debt ceiling with the threat of a government shutdown and the threat of potential default on federal debt over budget cuts. And so the Republicans want to trade deeper budget cuts for an increase in the debt ceiling, the ability to borrow to fund our programs, whereas President Obama says he wants to decouple those two and not link an increase in the debt ceiling with any talks on the budget at all. So that's a real, I'd say the number one issue right now is how that's going to play out, because John Boehner, who was more kind of the centrist on this before, has lined himself up with the more sort of extreme part of his party on this issue now, saying that, yeah, he wants to have even deeper cuts on the domestic spending side than increasing the debt ceiling.
Let me jump in, because we have news, and then we'll talk about other issues before Congress. This is the Ideas Network. Besides a vote to authorize or not the use of military force in Syria, what else is on Congress's agenda when it returns from recess? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 7:37 on this Tuesday, September the 3rd. We are talking with David Cannon, a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we want to know, what do you think is the most pressing issue facing Congress? What do you want Congress to do in terms of the debt ceiling, in terms of other issues before Congress, including the farm bill? How about immigration reform? What else? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So, Professor Cannon, just before news time, you were saying that there were two very important issues that Congress was facing upon return from recess, and one was the debt ceiling debate. What was the other one?
Well, the other was immigration reform, was the other thing, I think, top on the agenda nationally that you touched on. But then there's a third one, too, that you just mentioned that I think is of great interest locally, certainly, and in the Midwest, is the farm bill. Because something happened in August with the farm bill that hadn't happened, well, really, for decades. I think it goes back to the 1960s that this bipartisan compromise has been in place, where they've sort of coupled agricultural policy on crops and other programs for farmers, along with the food stamp program and other nutritional programs that are more of interest for urban areas. And that coalition then of urban and rural have had strong bipartisan support for agricultural bills for decades. Well, in August, the House split those two things apart, and because they really want to reduce funding for food stamps and nutritional programs, and they knew they couldn't do that if it was attached to the agricultural bill. So they separated those two in the House, and the Senate now is really not at all happy with that, and so we're kind of at an impasse. And the current farm bill expires on September 30th, and if nothing is done, we go back to the 1940s era law on agriculture, which would be just devastating for farmers. So something has to happen now in the next couple of weeks, and it's not clear how this impasse will be resolved.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, can it be resolved, especially now with Syria on the table?
Well, right. I mean, with Syria, with the debt ceiling, all the other pressing issues, this is something that really got pushed to the back burner, and off the front pages. And now I think that at least the people who are really concerned about this are going to have to put a lot of time and effort to try to get this resolved in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. Back to the debt ceiling, that needs to be resolved by mid-October?
Right. That's what we're hearing from the Treasury Department, is we have enough sort of emergency kind of measures they can use to be able to still borrow money up through mid-October. Once we hit that deadline, at that point we won't be able to pay all of our bills without additional borrowing.
Yeah. So how do you see that playing out in terms of the whether or not the deep budget cuts will have to happen in order to raise the debt ceiling or not?
Boy, well, last time Congress is the one that kind of blinked, and President Obama was able to get most of what he wanted. And it seems like the rhetoric we're hearing right now from the Republican leadership in the House is stronger than it was before, saying that they're going to be the ones not to blink this time. And so this could just be more position taking by them to try to get some kind of concessions from the White House. And so it's hard to know how this plays out for sure over the next 6 weeks, but you can say one thing for sure, it's not going to be easy. This is really going to be a difficult fight, I think, between the White House and the House Republicans on this question of the debt ceiling.
So what's at risk for those deep cuts?
Well, what's at risk? I think the biggest thing at risk is the potential default on federal debt. If that were to happen, that would be truly catastrophic for the world economy. Obviously, the U.S. government's never done that before. U.S. treasuries are seen as the safe haven for investors around the world. It's why the dollar is the world currency. It has the full backing of the faith and credit of the United States government, and so it's seen as the world's reserve currency. If we were to default on our federal debt, we would be severely tarnished. That image would be severely tarnished, and perhaps we'd lose our status as having the world's reserve currency. And so that really would be a huge development for the world economy. If we avoid that disaster, which I think we will, I mean, I can't imagine that Congress would push us over that cliff. So I think we'll resolve that problem. But then in trade, we are likely to get some deeper spending cuts on the domestic side, which then could be another drag on future economic growth, that as we cut spending, that does have an impact on the growth of the economy. And the so-called austerity budgets that have been very much in vogue on the House Republican side really could potentially do some damage to the growing economy.
Let's take a call from Will in Windsor. Hi, Will.
Yes, thank you. I think it's ridiculous for Congress to cut the budget and make it harder for the poor and working poor by kicking them off of programs or cutting programs that they need just to exist, and can find money to go into war at a whim when there's really no reason for it. And as far as credibility, I don't think the U.S. have much credibility in that region around Syria at all, because of their past record and because of the flawed intelligence that we went into Iraq on.
Yeah, thanks, Will. Well, it's kind of tying Syria and the budget together there. We have to make deep budget cuts, but what about the budgetary implications of Syria?
Right. Well, this actually, Will, raises a point that goes back to debates we've had since the Vietnam War era, in fact. Back in the Johnson administration, they called this the guns versus butter trade-off, as a way of talking about the cost of fighting a war in Southeast Asia, trading off against the war on poverty programs and the other programs that President Johnson was trying to fund for the poor. And that guns and butter trade-off is now a way that we generally talk about, trading off spending for military kind of intervention against programs for the poor and poverty programs and other domestic programs. And so Will is tapping into a long-standing debate that's been going on in American politics, and this is just the most recent incarnation of that. Now, specifically with Syria, we're not talking about a major, a land invasion, so we're not talking about a major commitment of troops the way we were, say, in Vietnam or even in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so on a budget scale, it's a slightly different or a very different kind of scale we're talking about in terms of the amount of money being committed. So I don't think there'd be quite as much in terms of that guns and butter trade-off in this specific case of Syria as there would be, say, as Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah. Is there any way to know, Professor Cannon, if the budget cuts that might be tied to raising the debt ceiling would indeed hurt the working poor, I think is the term Will used?
Right. Well, yeah, I think there's a little doubt about that. And you need to look no further than what's happening with the farm bill, the agriculture bill, to see exactly that happening. And this is the purpose of splitting the food stamps program from the farm bill is the desire to have deep cuts in that food stamp program. So I think Will is exactly right that, you know, that very high on the list of what would be cut on the House Republican budget would be programs like food stamps that are very much needed for the working poor and the poor in general.
Yeah. What about those who aren't working, the unemployment benefits? Where does that stand? Isn't there some work to be done there?
Well, right. So another sort of consequence of the economic recession of 2008-2009 is the long-term unemployed in this country. And we have had, you know, fairly strong bipartisan support for extending unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed. And that's something else that's on the table again in this round as well.
We are talking with David Cannon. He is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We are talking about the many issues facing Congress, and we welcome your input. What's the most pressing issue as far as you are concerned? What do you want to see Congress do when it comes to the debt ceiling, when it comes to the farm bill? How about immigration reform? We'll talk a little bit more about that after the break. And other issues. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 12 minutes before 8 on this Tuesday, September 3rd. Congress is returning from its summer recess this week, a variety of issues to tackle from the debt ceiling to the farm bill to immigration reform. We've already talked about Syria and the fact that President Obama has asked Congress for support to use military force in Syria. But what are the other issues on the congressional agenda? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is Sandy in Algoma. Hello, Sandy.
Hi. Hey, I think that with the farm bill, they really need to end the subsidies for the industrialized, the corporate agriculture, these big, huge mega farms. They're putting these little farmers out of business. We have somebody right down the road from us who just went out of business. He has been on that farm since he was born. His parents had it, and his son should have taken over, but they cannot compete because these guys get all these taxpayer-funded subsidies. Mm-hmm. He's going out of business.
Is subsidies for, she said, mega farms, I think, are they on the table for cutting in the farm bill, Professor Cannon?
Well, certainly there have been groups in Congress who wanted to cut the large farm subsidies for some time. There has always been enough support to keep those going that, you know, they're really not as much on the chopping block as, say, the food stamps program would be on the Republican side anyway. And so there has been talk for years of cutting those subsidies. And Sandy's right in terms of the concentration of the agricultural sector into more and more of the farm products that are produced in this country are produced by large farms rather than the small family farm. And we've seen that concentration going on now for several generations. So this is a very long, slow process happening in the farm sector. And part of that, I wouldn't put all of that at the feet of federal subsidies. Certainly there are a lot of other forces that are pushing the agricultural sector in that direction. But Sandy's right that the large corporate-owned farms do get, you know, billions of dollars in subsidies from the federal government.
Yeah. is there going to be time for comprehensive immigration reform, Professor Cannon? And will we see this pathway to citizenship?
Boy, that is a huge question. That is the other sort of, you know, other top issue I alluded to before. And the path to citizenship for the 11 million immigrants who already are here in the United States illegally is the big sticking point on this bill. That a lot of Republicans have said they simply will not support a path to citizenship. Now, there was an intriguing development just in the last week or so where there were some House Republicans saying that they would support a path to citizenship, but just not the one that currently is in the bill. And it wasn't exactly clear what they had in mind in terms of what their alternative path to citizenship would look like, but the fact that at least they're saying there's something else out there that might be acceptable to them, I think at least opens the door to more discussion. About 2-3 weeks ago, I would have said, no way, this is not going to happen. There's just not enough support on the Republican side to push this through, and it looked like it was just not going to go anywhere. But now we've had these few Republicans who've said that they are willing to talk about some alternative path to citizenship. And again, we don't really know yet what they have in mind, but I think that does open the door to maybe something happening on this that would allow this bill to go forward.
Chris in Watertown is with us. Hello, Chris.
Hi, great show as usual. I just think the whole comprehensive immigration reform would be a moot issue if Congress would just mandate E-verify to all employers, regardless of size. If you're not a U.S. citizen, it can't be properly verified, you don't work, and then there's no under-the-table work for non-citizens to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Chris is right. In an ideal world, that would be a great answer to this issue. But the problem is that so many of the illegal workers are working, you know, as domestic household, people, you know, cleaning houses, in the construction industry, day laborers, and it really is pretty impossible to expect, you know, every single person who hires someone to be able to have access to E-Verify. You're literally talking about, you know, people who might be employing one or two people to do work at their home, then they would have access to E-Verify. And so that's why in the law there always has been this exemption for just, you know, larger employers using the E-Verify program, not everyone who hires someone. And so, again, I think in an ideal world, Chris is right. That would be a great solution here. But in terms of practically how you'd go about implementing that, it just would be really tough to do.
Yeah. So why are Republicans changing their tune on this issue, Professor Cannon? Is it simply because they want Hispanic votes in the next election?
Well, I mean, I think that's certainly a big part of the politics of this, is that, you know, the Republicans did a lot of deep kind of introspection after this last election to see what went wrong and why they, you know, lost an election they thought that they should have won. And the Latino vote was certainly a big part of that story. And so you have many Republicans are saying, you know, look, we can't continue on the path we've been going on immigration policy if we want to try to broaden the base of the Republican Party. And so for many Republicans, I think that is part of the motivation here, is to say that, you know, we need to make our party more friendly to Latino voters and have a policy on immigration reform that will be, you know, more attractive to them. So I think that's certainly part of it. I think another part of it is on economic grounds, that many members of Congress are hearing from small business owners who want a solution on this. They want to be able to hire people and have them work legally in a program that will allow them to be here legally. And they don't want to be in that position of potentially breaking the law by hiring someone who's illegal. And so the business people also are having their voices heard on this. And so I think it's both of those things that are pushing the Republican Party right now to revisit this.
You know, President Obama announced a major climate change project earlier this year. Is any of that stuff going to be addressed?
Boy, I would be surprised if that, you know, made its way up the legislative agenda, given how crowded it is right now with these other big issues we've been talking about. I mean, I think I would like to see some attention on that. I think that's something that we are going to have to address as a nation, you know, sooner rather than later. But just given that everything else is on the agenda now for the next, 4 to 6 weeks, it's hard to see how that one, breaks into the top, three or four that are going to be getting most of the attention.
Yeah. Is there another deadline for the Bush tax cuts? Are they set to expire at the end of the year?
Well, the deal that was reached on this last fiscal cliff was to actually, make those, at least most of those tax cuts permanent. Now, the one that I, top of my head, actually, I can't remember, is what they did with the estate tax, because the estate tax is one that they keep on, pushing, down the road to, change back to the levels they were at, in 2002, and then, to have it go, way back up. And I can't remember what they actually did on the estate tax, but the other ones, were actually made permanent as part of the last round of negotiations on the fiscal cliff.
Yeah. What about jobs in the economy overall? Is there anything specific that Congress is planning on doing to improve our lot?
Well, the one thing that still is having, quite a bit of discussion, and there are groups in Congress anyway pushing for this, is a large infrastructure bill, because every week or so it seems like there's another, bridge that collapses or another, problem with crumbling infrastructure. And so that's clearly another long-term thing we do need to invest more money in this country, is rebuilding our roads and bridges, airports, and the water systems in many cities are also in need of major work. And this is a big jobs program. The amount of money that have to be spent to, to fix the roads and bridges and water systems is in the trillions of dollars long-term. And so some members of Congress are saying, we should take advantage now of these super low interest rates we have and borrow more money to actually rebuild our infrastructure. It's the perfect time to do it. It'd be a great jobs program for the economy. And so there is some talk of that. I'm not sure that this will be able to get majority support in both houses because, again, the House Republicans are very firmly on the camp of the of cutting spending, not increasing spending right now.
Yeah. Well, let's circle back then to where we started our conversation this hour with the Syria vote. What are you expecting and when?
Well, so the Congress comes back next Monday, and we will have had quite a few hearings by that point. The House Foreign Relations Committee is starting hearings this week also, I believe, on Thursday. And so, we'll probably have votes, I would guess, as early as the middle of next week, where the Congress will have to decide what they're going to do on this. And the Washington Post has a nice thing on their website where they have a count of the publicly taken positions by members of the House and Senate on this issue. And at this point, only about half of House members have actually taken a public position. And so I think there are a lot of members who are taking this wait-and-see approach and let's see what happens in the hearings and want to get more information before they take a public position. So we really don't know yet how this is going to break. But as I said before, I'd be surprised if it doesn't pass, just because I can't imagine the president going ahead with this if he didn't have some assurances from leaders that, we can get this passed.
Well, we'll leave it there for now. I want to thank you so much for joining us, especially on this is the first day of classes of the fall semester at UW-Madison, isn't
it? That's right. Yep, we head back to class today.
All right. Well, have a good semester, and we'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Thank you very much.
David Cannon is a professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks to Robin Cherry for producing this program. Thanks to Christy Taylor for on-air direction, and thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.